Welcome to Now You Know. I'm Catherine Sussman. Today, our guest is Dr. Jeffrey Ventry, former marine mammal trainer at SeaWorld from 1987 to 1995. Jeff spent 7 years working with cetaceans and 1 year working with pinnipeds. After seeing killer whales in the wild, it radically altered his perspective on keeping cetaceans in captivity and led him to become a co-founder of the advocacy group Voice of the Orcas. Jeff has also co-authored several science-based works and articles, and he's featured in the documentary Blackfish, as well as in the book Death at SeaWorld. He's also a lead organizer of the biannual Superpod Symposium in the San Juan Islands. Jeff, it's such a treat to have the opportunity to speak to you today. Thank you so much for being a guest on the show.
Catherine, thanks for having me on. I really appreciate it.
If we could begin just by having you tell your story, how you ended up working at SeaWorld, and then how you eventually flipped positions on cetacean captivity, that would be amazing.
Yeah, so I began work in November of 1987 at SeaWorld, just days after John Sillick was crushed by a killer whale at SeaWorld of San Diego. And so for the first 6 months at SeaWorld, everyone was out of the water for safety reasons, which is interesting because things cycled back and eventually Don was killed at SeaWorld in 2010. But I worked there for 8 years. I spent my first year at Shamu Stadium and also my last 2 years at Shamu Stadium with stints at Sea Lion and Otter 1 year, and about 4 years at Whale and Dolphin Stadium. So I got to work with all the species that SeaWorld had in their animal training department. And so that gave me a kind of a nice overview of captivity because I got to work with literally every single captive animal in the park that was in shows, not on display. And the big thing that kind of changed my ways were two things. One, it was my own personal growth. I realized that I was involved in entertainment. And before getting involved with SeaWorld, you know, I had dreamed of going to medical school and so on and so forth. And I know a girlfriend that I worked with at the time at Shamu Stadium in 1994, Alana Finelli, asked me a couple algebra problems while we were backstage at Shamu Stadium. And I realized I had once taken calculus, you know, and I couldn't even solve a basic algebra problem. So I felt like my mental state was deteriorating being involved with animal entertainment on my end, personal growth wise. And then when I came back to Shamu Stadium for my second go round, so to speak, I noticed the teeth damage and just basically the horrific lifestyles of the killer whales, more so even than the other whales, which also had it bad. And so that is what kind of flipped me over. And I began speaking about these issues while I was still there and accepted a kind of a 2 week position with Ken Balcom at the Center for Whale Research to go participate in Orca Survey for a couple weeks.
Was that while you were still working at SeaWorld?
I accepted the position while I was still at SeaWorld. And then when I actually did it in June of 1996, I was no longer at SeaWorld. So yeah, I flipped 180 pretty quickly. And Gabriella Cowperthwaite actually captured that in the end of Blackfish, where I talked about whales swimming in straight lines with straight dorsal fins. That was actually me referring to my first time seeing killer whales in 1996 with Astrid Van Ginneken and Kelly Balcom and the people that were involved with Orca Survey back then. And so that's why when we started working after Don was killed in February of 2010, in July of 2011, I organized the first Superpod gathering, and Gabriella Cowperthwaite and Tim Zimmerman kind of followed the ex-trainers to San Juan Island, and that's where she got about 70% of the footage for Blackfish. But it goes back to me accepting that place with Ken at the Center for Whale Research and having access to the whales, because it's like going through a one-way door. Once you see them in the wild, there's really no going back.
It's amazing. Our entire podcast, it's called Now You Know, because what we're trying to do is just expose hidden issues or things that people might not think about. And what you're describing really was like flipping a light switch, isn't it?
Yeah, so it sure is. Yeah, it sure was. And the same thing, interestingly, John Jett got interviewed by 60 Minutes Australia. They flew JJ out to San Juan Island in, I think, 2011. And even though JJ had been a dear friend of mine, still is, and we felt similarly on captivity while we worked together, the first time he saw killer whales was like 2011. And I think it kind of brought tears to both of our eyes because it is such an instantaneous, now you know, kind of moment. So It's amazing.
It's really funny because I don't know if you know this about me, probably not, but my dream was to be a dolphin trainer. And
right.
I used to go down and pay to do internships in the Bahamas. And the facility I used to go to was called semi-captivity because the animals are actually in like an enclosure, like a closed off bay. They take the dolphins on what they call like walks, like doggy walks, and the dolphins go beside the boat to do programs in the open ocean. And it's funny, even working there, and that place was pretty good in terms of like they didn't withhold food, it was positive reinforcement, the dolphins were kind of allowed to like mate naturally there, and you know, they weren't separated from their young, so all of those elements were good. I still had a big problem with it. So I came back to Canada, and that's when I first went to a Marineland protest and saw Naomi Rose at a screening of Blackfish, and I had that same kind of flip, even though I was at a good facility.
Yeah, nice. Yeah, so I've spent a couple weeks on two different years, 2013 and 2016, along with Jeff Friedman, who is now a resident on San Juan Island, and some of the Blackfish cast, doing basically two humpback whale trips where we did swims with humpbacks. And there's a facility there called Ocean World Marina, I think, where they, I think, do the same thing that you're talking about. They just have the dolphins kind of corralled in the little pen right there. And, you know, it's a swim with program, pretty devastating. It doesn't sound like it's as good as the one that you worked for, but it was really kind of the juxtaposition of the dolphins being right there in the little bay.
Exactly.
And the ocean being right there was tragic. You know, I think there's quite a few swim with programs in the Dominican Republic now that I've looked into a little bit.
And no matter how you swing it, really, I mean, these animals are coming back. Yes, they're coming back, but the truth is they're coming back because they're used to eating dead fish. So they didn't really know what to do. They were scared of sharks if they saw a shark. Like, they didn't really know what to do in the wild, these animals. So it's not really fair. It wasn't fair in my mind to think, oh, this is like okay ethically because the dolphins are choosing to come back.
Right. It's really going to be interesting to see how the belugas and orcas that were recently freed in Russia will adapt, or how many will survive and how many won't, you know. I'm not tracking that personally, but I know that so far I think all the belugas and the orcas were released, and some had tags on them, so I guess we'll find out.
Yeah. So, Jeff, I wanted to just sort of give you a little bit of a rundown on what's happening for us. So we have this podcast now, you know, and every month we have a theme of different issues that we're trying to expose. So this month is basically the controversy of Swim with Dolphins programs. So I actually interviewed a couple of weeks ago one of the head campaign managers for World Animal Protection, mm-hmm. and they have a new campaign, which is basically to call attention to the multi-billion dollar dolphin entertainment industry. So their campaign is basically trying to influence airlines, cruise ships, travel agencies to stop promoting Swim with Dolphins programs. So I wanted to sort of ask you how you feel about, because I know a lot of your experience, you've worked with everything. I wanted mm-hmm. to ask you more specifically about dolphins, because I've heard you speak a lot on orcas. What are your feelings in terms of the welfare of dolphins compared to other species in captivity?
Yeah. So, yeah, I worked with, I would say, about 10 dolphins, Goofy, Toad, Celeste, Lori, Larney, Stan, Dixie, Carol, Tucker, and a couple others that I can't think of right now at SeaWorld. And they have the same issues as killer whales. You know, there's a social hierarchy in the situation where I was at for 4 years. Goofy was the supreme leader. And one of the tragic behaviors that I witnessed personally was there was a young dolphin named Celeste, whose parents were Shannon and Lester. And Lester, and I worked with those two dolphins too. So she had a really clever name, was a really cute, sweetheart dolphin but was the lowest member and the social hierarchy at Whale and Dolphin Stadium. So the dominant animals, including Goofy mainly, but also Dixie and Carol and Toad, knew that if they would basically beat her up or displace her right after she got her food, she would cough up her fish as kind of like a strategy to keep them off of her. And so, but the other dolphins learned very quickly it was an easy way to get fish. So basically this led to chronic regurgitation with Celeste, who eventually died of malnutrition, because this went on for months and months and months, and she just kept losing weight and then one day passed away. So that's a super tragic story of how the dominance hierarchy in an artificial pod at SeaWorld led directly to this whale dying of malnutrition.
Another awful.
Another story also regarding Celeste is that these pools are so small, and you can look at pictures of the Whale and Dolphin Stadium at SeaWorld in Orlando right now, and you can see those two back pools. There's the main show pool, by the way, which used to house killer whales before they built the Shamrock Stadiums in the 1980s. Super small pools in the back where animals are held right before the gates open and they do a segment in the show. Well, one time, Celeste was also back in that small pool. It's just a tiny circular pool, not much bigger than a big jacuzzi, basically. And there was two or three dolphins in there. And one of the dolphins went to go displace Celeste. And displacement is what they refer to as like a dominance move to kind of show your muscle. Celeste accelerated in that back pool. And where the intake port for the water filtration system, you know, there's like an open hole in the middle of the pool. When Celeste accelerated, her tail fluke hit the PVC edge of that intake pipe and basically lopped off side of her tail. Yeah, basically she self-amputated. They tried to sew it back on, the vets did, but it became necrotic. Basically her fluke was cut in half. And so that was a deformity that she lived with until she died of malnutrition within the next year.
That's terrible. It's interesting because you're talking about like the safety issues for dolphins. And I know even at the facility that I worked at, that is what I think one of the quote unquote better ones. They've had, I think, about four dolphins die because they've essentially drowned. They've gotten caught in the netting because this facility has netting because they're not concrete tanks. So there's that. But I wanted to ask you your views on the safety issue when it comes to humans as well. So I'm not sure at SeaWorld, they don't offer swim with dolphins programs, do they, for the public? But
they do at the sister park that is right next to SeaWorld in Orlando.
Is that owned by, so that's owned
yeah,
by
SeaWorld?
Yeah, it's
SeaWorld Discovery Cove, and they have a dolphin lagoon with a swim with dolphin program right there. So there were people, when they opened this Discovery Cove Park, which is like a full-on swim with park, I think with dolphins and maybe belugas, a lot of the staff that I worked with eventually became like management at the Dolphin Lagoon Swim With program. So yeah, SeaWorld does have swim with programs in Orlando.
Yeah, like, I mean, just from my experience, one time I went back to see the dolphins I had been working with, and my friend was still the head trainer there. So she kind of like let me go in for free and get in the water during a swim with dolphins program. And this one young dolphin who I was so excited to see because I had worked with him, I think my energy was really high. And when I got in the water, he grabbed onto my thigh and he wouldn't let go. And even though she was the most experienced trainer, she like blew her whistle to recall him. He didn't let go. She blew it again. He let go for a split second and then came right back round to me and grabbed on again. He didn't hurt me, but I was really disconcerted. So I was just wondering, like, there must be stuff like this that happens all the time, if that's just my personal experience.
Absolutely. And I've said this while I worked at SeaWorld, because I did get to work with all the cetaceans in their show program. Dolphin aggressions against trainers, whether they're sexually based or just aggression or whatever, happen much more frequently than people realize. The only difference is that when a killer whale gets aggressive, it makes news. But I can remember people getting fluked and rammed by dolphins all the time. So on a pound for pound basis, I'd say dolphins deliver, especially now that there's no swimming with killer whales at SeaWorld, but even back then, dolphins were basically beating the crap out of trainers on a regular basis when I worked there, whether it was ramming them, displacing them, dunking them, and so on and so forth. And you're still, in Goofy's case, she was, I think, probably 520 pounds. I'm not exactly sure. I think that's probably accurate. And so, you know, you're helpless. And they're also much more maneuverable in human terms when they're right next to you than a killer whale. So yeah, they pose just as much, if not more, of a threat to a human in the water as a killer whale does.
Do you think that there is anything educational, like any positive education that does come out of seeing these kinds of animals in captivity?
I think that people walk away with their dolphin swim experiences. A lot of them are undereducated or uneducated about the topic, and they're not looking at it from the dolphin's point of view, which I think is what Naomi's Twitter
behind the smile.
From the dolphin's perspective. So I think people come out of there with an exhilarating experience, but they're just not interpreting the dolphin's perspective. All they're seeing is what they got out of it, and they can go back to their family and friends and say, hey, I swam with a dolphin today, and it was great. Well, it might have had a an impact on that person, but it certainly has a negative impact on the dolphins. And, you know, one of the things that SeaWorld leverages to its public relations credit is they teach a lot of anthropomorphized behaviors or tricks, so to speak. You know, they train all the animals to do mimic behaviors like head shakes and head shake yes, head shake no, hula maneuvers where they spin around or they mimic the trainers. And people really sometimes think that the dolphin is actually saying yes and no, but really it's just a, you know, a B.F. Skinner-esque behavior modification strategy where you train this animal to do basically A to B movements with its head, and when they do it properly, you give them a fish. So some people misinterpret the experience, and I think misinterpret it in a way that they feel as if it was positive, but there's really nothing positive from the dolphin's perspective.
And aren't some of those behaviors actually aggressive behaviors in the wild that seem sort of innocuous in captivity? I don't know if you could give us some examples of what that might be.
I certainly can. There's evidence of it all over YouTube. One of my favorite killer whales, a Taima, people go up to the killer whale viewing area or the dolphin viewing area, and the whale, they're banging on the glass, and the whales come up and do jaw pops, which are essentially threat displays to the people, and the people react to that jaw pop as if the whale is talking back to them somehow. Well, the whale is kind of talking back to them with a threat display, and these jaw popping maneuvers in the wild are threat displays. Unfortunately, killer whales and dolphins, they do these at each other with gates in between, and that's how they bust out their teeth. And jaw popping is not a happy behavior. It's a very sad example of the stress caused by captivity.
Something that really struck me, just changing gears here a little bit, when I watched Blackfish, the thing that I find the most horrific is actually the breeding of the animals. Like, yes. I just can't even believe that that's ethically, you know, is that what goes on with the dolphins as well? Can you talk about that?
Yeah, I've watched AI sessions with dolphins. Basically, people glove up, masturbate the dolphins, and collect semen, and then they cryopreserve it or inject it directly into the females and hope that, you know, they are successful at creating a pregnancy. So yeah, I've watched it. At the time when I was at SeaWorld,
which ended in December of 1995,
we were actively working with Tilcom, but he had not yet learned how to present his penis with manual stimulation. So it sounds just as gross as it is. And people literally put on the gloves, break out a couple tubes of KY jelly, lube up, and just start rubbing and hope that that large penis comes out, and eventually they were successful. And you can see pictures of this online. But with dolphins, they had that perfected long before I even got to SeaWorld. So they were ejaculating all over the place, basically. You know, dolphins, people talk about dolphins being very sexual creatures. It seems to be true.
I don't even know what to say after that, but it's just so unfathomable what humans feel they have the right to do sometimes to other species.
Yeah.
But on the subject of Tilikum, if he hadn't have attacked Don, I know he had a history of already having attacked, I believe, two other people. Do you think he could have been a candidate for release since he was born in the wild?
Tilikum, not so much, mainly because of his poor dentition. I co-authored a paper with Drs. John Jett, Ingrid Visser, Carolyn Locke, and Jordan Walsh on the teeth damage that occurs from killer whales living in captivity.
One way they do it is through not neurotic behaviors and also those threat displays I mentioned earlier. They chew on concrete, they bang their heads, they chomp down on metal bars, and this is how they knock out their teeth. So I have participated in flushing out Tilikum's mouth with a betadine saline solution where I work there, because we'd have to do it two or three times a day. And he had a bunch of open bore holes in his teeth. What I mean by that is that the teeth of a killer whale is several inches long, and it's shaped like an upside down ice cream cone. So when they bust off their teeth, the core of that tooth eventually rots. And so the trainers, with the help of the vet staff, take a Dremel tool and drill out or bore out the tooth, creating a hollow tube. So what happens when they eat, especially dead fish, the fish particles and roe and, you know, anything can get trapped in that bore hole. And that leads to local infections like abscesses, but also systemic infections, which I suspect is the main cause of death in killer whales. Of course, SeaWorld just always says they're dying of pneumonia, but I think that their pneumonia is coming from particles of bacteria getting introduced into their bloodstream from these open boreholes caused by captivity, leading to decreased immunity, chronic use of antibiotics to treat this, and then eventually their immune system shut down. They get a upper respiratory infection, and boom, they're done. So Tilikum was not a good candidate for release. I'll tell you who is a great candidate is Lolita, because she's got a great set of teeth. I don't think any of her teeth are completely busted off or bored out. So I think if she were to be placed into a sea pen off of San Juan Island or in the San Juan Islands, I think she'd do really well. I think her family would eventually swim by, and I don't know that they would ever fully release her, but I think they could. I think the fear of releasing someone that's been in captivity with another killer whale for a while, Hugo died back in 1980, I believe. She's been by herself, you know, for a long time, decades. I think the threat of her introducing
a pathogen or something,
a resistant pathogen into the wild population would be the main reason that they would not fully release her. But I bet you if you took that risk factor away, she would probably reintegrate. That's just opinion.
For people that don't know who Lolita is, she is basically the last remaining southern resident orca in captivity. Is that correct? And it's just such a travesty that we know where her family is. Those are the whales that we watch at the Superpod conferences.
That's like, right.
It's just unbelievable. She's a member of an endangered population, and yet people have been trying for decades, isn't it, to have
yeah,
her.
Yeah, for sure. And her equivalent at SeaWorld in San Diego is Corky. And Corky has been there, I think, since 1969. She's a northern resident, and we also know where her family is. The difference between Corky and Lolita is that Corky has absolutely destroyed her teeth. I don't know that she has one healthy tooth in her entire mouth. So releasing Corky would have the same risk factors of resistant pathogens, but also the fact that she's got really poor dental health, you know, and back before modern dentistry, poor dental health was the leading cause of death in humans. And so you can see that captivity itself is perpetuating in a couple of ways. It causes health issues that make the whales poor candidates for release on one hand. And on the other hand, all of the breeding that's occurred at SeaWorld has produced hybrid whales, which have no home.
Natural family, I guess.
Right. And so, you know, SeaWorld's claim of wanting to one day maybe repopulate killer whale populations is a bunch of bunk. It's just all public relations and BS.
And just getting back to what you were describing with the teeth and everything we've been talking about, is just so invasive, this life they lead, from the drilling of the teeth, flushing out their mouths, to masturbating the whales. This is definitely not the glossy, like dolphin smiling, swim with dolphins image you have for cetaceans when you visit one of these places.
Absolutely.
It's really funny because despite all of the animal welfare issues, the safety issues for both the animals and the humans, all these things we've been talking about, damage to wild populations, there really does seem to be an exception in the public's perception that interacting with especially Atlantic bottlenose dolphins is somehow okay. Like, why is that? Is that just because of the smile, you think, or is it because they're so heavily promoted? It's such a massive industry. I feel like with killer whales, it's a bit more evident to people because they're so massive, the space right. concerns.
I think the obvious size factor does make a difference in people's perception. Dolphins have been in captivity much longer than killer whales in general. And so the industry, so to speak, the display, the animal display slash captivity industry has had, you know, over a century to perfect the marketing of dolphins in captivity. And for whatever reason, dolphins, including killer whales, have ascended to this, you know, mystical semi-godlike status in the perception of our brains. And so the opportunity to swim with one of these animals, you know, that's what got me to SeaWorld, right? That's why people want to be dolphin trainers. That's why, you know, people just have these unrealistic thoughts about what it means to go to one of these parks. And I think Blackfish and the anti-captivity movement in general is helping to pull the curtain back and inform a lot more people. But we haven't gotten to everybody yet. In fact, as I'm planning Superpod 7, and it happens every year, whether I'm dealing with the San Juan Community Theater or this year, the Mullis Center, or just different businesses on San Juan Island, it's hard for me to believe how many people haven't even seen Blackfish. You know, we kind of presume that everyone's seen it, and really, and a lot of people have seen it, but it's really interesting how many people have not yet been exposed to that messaging, that live
in a place that relies on cetaceans as a multi-million dollar industry.
We're talking about land-based and water-based whale watching and so forth. I mean, the entire economy of Friday Harbor is kind of based around animals, right? And people come out there and still, you know, haven't been introduced to some of the most effective messaging that's been put out there. And I'm referring, of course, to the science, but also the Blackfish and all the work that you guys are doing. A lot of people just still don't know.
It's amazing.
Yeah, it really is.
What is your position on captivity in general then? Like, are you anti-captivity? Do you feel like it's species specific? Like, would you take kids to the zoo?
No, I'm not an advocate of animal display. I am an advocate for rehab centers. You know, I like the fact that we're now retiring elephants to 10,000 acres in Tennessee or in Florida or wherever that is. I like the idea of trying to replicate natural environmental conditions. But, you know, you go to a zoo, the saddest thing ever is to see an elephant with its ankle shackled or to see a lion pacing back and forth in a small cage. I am definitely not an advocate of the display industry, and especially places like Marineland, which is kind of sets the benchmark of atrocities in my mind.
What do you think of, there's a few places that are like swim with dolphins in the wild programs where it's like a researcher who will allow tourists to kind of go on an ecotourist adventure, not touch the animals. It's done very carefully. Do you think that is also unethical, or do you think that's slightly different?
I'm not a fan of dolphin swim with programs in any format. I think, truthfully, I don't have a lot of knowledge about this, the setup for specific places. I know there's a place in Key West where I guess what they do is they have dolphins in a little bay area. And then when they go out on, you know, on boats, the dolphins follow them because that's what they're trained to do. That's how they're getting their nutrition. So I think anytime, you know, we intervene in the natural lives of these animals, that's negative, and people can dress it up how they want to. I do think that, you know, early on in captivity with both killer whales and dolphins, we learned some good basic science about these animals, like their blood types. And, you know, we're discussing things like dental health and, you know, survival in captivity. Killer whales, we know, don't do as well in captivity as they do in the wild. They don't live as long. Same with dolphins. We learned a little bit about their biology. You know, Dr. Marino did that famous mirror self-recognition study. And so this has all been done because of captivity, but I don't think we're gleaning any useful information any at this point. You know what I mean? I think the best research is done in the wild with wild animals that aren't coerced into following a boat for food.
So just before you leave, what is your advice to people, just to the average person who is taking an interest in this issue and wants to help?
Well, first of all, and I'm completely biased, I'm inviting everyone, including SeaWorld trainers, to attend SuperPod 7, which occurs July 20th through 20th.
I'll be there for my third time.
Yeah, that's a fun time. Whether you like to get out on a boat or have feelings against, there's plenty of whale watching that can be done there.
I love it. You know, my favorite, is just going to Lime Kiln Point, is it? And just watching
exactly. Watching the whale swim by. It's not really a conference because it's not really that formal, but it kind of is the top, at least a large group of the top killer whale experts in the world kind of converge on this area and make presentations. Also, experts on things like the Lower Snake River dams and salmon restoration. These people are all congregating there on their own dime, by the way. No one's making any money on this. In fact, we fund it with volunteer work and some small donations to like rent the theater or rent the Mola Center. But that's a great start because what that does, it gets everybody there together. It's got a big social component to it. So there's a lot.
It's actually so magical. I'm bringing my daughter this time. Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a lot of what I would say cross-pollination. Lori Marino does a scholar advocacy program where she brings students ranging from grade schoolers to college students. She curates a scholar advocacy program. So people want to jumpstart their or inject their interest or their activism or their or whatever you want to call it, their science-based advocacy. I think SuperPod 7 is a good start. join us there. It's a free event. Basically, you just got to get there, and it can be expensive to stay there, but just, you know, people rent houses together. They try to find really great ways to do it. So start there, meet some people. I know that one of my, who's become a friend now, Mariah Kirby, she first started attending these Superpod events as a scholar advocate. Now she's working with Lori Marino, putting the scholar advocacy program together. So she's graduated, and in a recent email, she said, "You know, I'm a big girl now. You know, I'm taking over." So, you know,
and she's an author too.
Yeah, she wrote a book that's available on Amazon. So yeah, she's just a super science-based advocate for the whales, and it was Blackfish that flipped her. You know, I think she had wanted to be a whale or dolphin trainer back in the day, and then you know, Blackfish has been an entry point for so many people. So that's another thing people can do if they're listening to this podcast and haven't yet watched Blackfish. Do that. It tends to show the perspective of the animal more so than most documentaries do, and also kind of follows the transition of, you know, several former trainers as we all switched, which is how our interview today started. What flipped you? And so you can actually watch our transition in the movie. So that's a good entry point. But, you know, science-based advocacy is always needed. People to get out and study these animals, whether it's in the lab or in the field, that's always needed. And basically just spread the word. I think we're at a very tough place environmentally. I would say that the biosphere in general is at a tipping point. I mean, we're moving humans into places that have been traditionally places where animals lived, you know, just by pure numbers, 7.7 billion humans. I think the animal advocacy movement has to get into the whole idea of population overshoot. You know, the carrying capacity of the biosphere itself is being pushed to the limits just by human activity and the toxification, rivers and the ocean, as well as people aren't talking as much about ocean acidification as they should. I know that as a medical doctor, you know, when the pH changes in human blood, there's a very tight range. I believe it's 7.35 to 7.45. That's the acidity of your blood. If you get outside of that very small window, you die. And that's what's happening with the ocean. We've already pushed it out of the normal margin so much that animals that rely on, you know, calcium carbonates to make shells, for example, can no longer do that. We've lost, I think, 40 to 50% of all the world's phytoplankton. That's a huge oxygen source we've lost. And when we lose this polar ice cap, which looks like it could happen in the next 15 years, the temperature of the Arctic Ocean is going to go from 32 degrees to room temperature very quickly, and that's going to wipe out a lot of critters that are up there. So unless we figure out a way to extract carbon dioxide from the atmosphere, change our ways, maybe move to an energy-based, a green energy, you know, the Green New Deal, basically, unless we can pull that off, I think we're in trouble, even as a human species, of living on this planet for much longer. So there's micro issues and there's macro issues. Right now we're talking about one small piece of the ecological web, and that is captivity. And a lot of people are doing good work on that, but I think we need to rein in the birth rates versus the death rates of humans, lower human population, you know, hopefully voluntarily, because Mother Nature is going to do it herself if we don't do it in the form of disease, warfare, whatever it is.
Jeff, you are just such an amazing advocate for animals and the environment. Thank you. And thank you so much for doing this. It's just been phenomenal to talk to you and learn from you today. Thank you.